Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we'll hear from a group helping veterans enter the construction field and meet a Minnesota veteran whose career took him into space. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General John Jensen.
This week marks the anniversary of the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. As Americans, we all share a connection to that day, which President Roosevelt said shall live in infamy. But as Minnesotans, we have an additional historic connection. You may not know it, but Minnesotans fired the first American shots in the Pacific Theater of World War II. In 1899, the Minnesota legislature authorized the formation of a naval militia with chapters in Bemidji, Crosby, Duluth, and Pine City. As war approached, our brave Minnesotans shipped off and became the unit aboard the USS Ward. A little more than 2 hours before the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Ward was on patrol outside the harbor when they saw a small enemy submarine following a supply ship. At 6:45 a.m., the crew fired two shots from her 4-inch gun, sinking the sub. For many years, some doubted whether Ward had really sunk that submarine until 2002, when scientists found the vessel on the bottom of the ocean with 2 4-inch holes through its hull. Today, you can see and touch a piece of our history by visiting the state capitol grounds, where the Ward's gun now resides as a monument to the bravery of those who served aboard.
Thank you, General Jensen. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.
Joining me now is retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dwayne Digger Carey. Colonel, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Glad to be here.
Sir, I understand that you're here from Minnesota. You were born in Minnesota, and you're a Minnesota man.
Yes, sir. Pretty much was born in St. Paul, and parents were very young, and my dad was in the Air Force, and we bumped around for a little while, but after a few years, ended up back here.
So you went eventually to Highland Park High School, and you're a graduate from the University of Minnesota.
Yes, sir, but it wasn't quite a linear progression. When I graduated from high school, I knew I wasn't a real strong student, and I had no desire to go to college, but bumped around for a couple of years living life the hard way and decided I might want to join the military. In order to do that, if I want to be an officer, I had to go to college. It was very unfair, but got through the program at the U of M, and it's just had a wonderful career in the Air Force.
And a proud Gopher, and back here in Minnesota, and had a terrific career in the Air Force. And I understand you were commissioned in 1981, sir?
That's correct. I was in the ROTC program out at the University of Minnesota, and I got commissioned in 1981, but I had qualified for pilot training, and the Air Force told me they didn't have any slots open for another year, so my beautiful wife here convinced me to stay at the U long enough to pick up a master's degree in aerospace engineering, and boy, did that pay off dividends later on. So,
quite a career. We'll find out about that in a few minutes. I understand, sir, that you flew an A-10.
Yes, sir. I started out of pilot training. I got an A-10 and flew those for about 5.5 years and loved every minute of it. I was given the opportunity to fly F-16s after that and then jumped on it, and my wife and I did a lot of overseas time during those days, and because of that master's degree I just told you about, it qualified me for test pilot school, and I got into the test pilot program out at Edwards Air Force Base and did a bunch of stuff that my wife told me not to tell her about when I came home at night.
Always best that way, sir. I want to ask you about that A-10A, the close air support aircraft. That looks like one heck of a workhorse.
It is, and it's really fun to fly. It flies really good. You know, I didn't realize what an awesome airplane that was until I was a test pilot and I got a chance to put my hands on 35 or 40 different kinds of airplanes. And after it was all over, I reviewed my records and I says, dang, I started off in an A-10, and that's about the best flying jet I ever ended up touching.
And they used that quite extensively in the first Gulf War.
You're darn right they did. The Air Force actually... I had considered retiring that airplane back in the early 90s, and then Desert Storm popped up and gave her another 30 years of life, because after that war, the Army came and told the Air Force, you will not be allowed to retire that airplane. That's the best one you got, and they're still flying them.
They didn't have anything to replace it with, did they?
No, they don't, and I go, I do a lot of work at colleges, ROTC units all over the United States, Air Force Academy, and it's amazing there's still kids in the audience that want to graduate and fly the A-10. They're still flying that beauty, and I love it. It's not the coolest airplane to look at, but, boy, she does the job. And like you say, there's nothing else that can do it. There's nothing else that can do that job, close air support like that thing can.
Close air support is critical in some of those battles, and I don't know how you'd replace it, perhaps with a helicopter. But
I don't know. They're going to have magic to replace that.
We hope they keep flying them for a while, sir.
Me too.
And then you went on and completed F-16 training, 1988.
Yes, sir. I had 5.5 years in A-10s, and I was flying out of South Korea. And the Air Force gave me the opportunity to fly a different plane. And my wife and I looked at it, and we decided F-16s would be fun because they do a little close air support, and they do air-to-air and air-to-ground and different kinds of things, and I'm an easily bored person. So we decided on Vipers, F-16s, and then my wife wanted to go to Europe. So we were over in Spain for 3 years out of Torrejon flying that thing.
Sir, is it safe to say you like the speed of an F-16?
Yeah. I think most people would. You know, my wife got a chance to get an F-16 there when we were at Edwards, and she experienced that power a little bit. Now she wants a dang sports car.
I'll bet she didn't ride an F-16 twice, though.
No, she rode it. She got a chance to ride it. We never got airborne, but she got a chance to feel that. We had a chance to run the engine up and release the brakes, and she really liked it. No, it's a lot of power. It's a lot of power.
And I can tell just looking at you when you're talking about it, sir, you enjoyed that, didn't you?
Yeah. So I talk to a lot of young people around the country, and I tell some of them, I say, you know, if you're in a position in life where you got to work for a living, in other words, you know, mom and dad aren't so rich, you could take it easy for the rest of your life, a pilot is a great job to have. It's fun, and you don't even have to be passionate about flying. It's just a fun. Every morning I woke up, I actually looked forward to going to work because I was going to fly jets.
Sir, and all that training at the University of Minnesota set you up. 1992, you worked as a F-16 experimental test pilot. And it says here you logged over 4,300 hours in more than 35 types of aircraft.
Yep. Yeah, I'm too lazy to ever go back and really figure out exactly how many hours or exactly how many aircraft, so that about says it right there, and it was wonderful. It was great.
Sir, it looks like you pretty well figured out how to go from one aircraft to another and get them flying.
You know, it's not as hard as people think. Airplanes, basically, you need about 5 or 6 different numbers and airspeeds you have to remember, and then you're capable. If you're a test pilot, you're capable of flying just about anything. Airplanes are all more similar than they are different. They've all got wings. You got to get going to fly them. You got to slow down to land them.
The instrumentation is probably pretty the same.
Instrumentation is pretty consistent across the board. Now, when you get into the spaceship business, that's a little different. They are different, but jets.
Sir,
jets and airplanes are pretty close.
We're going to talk about NASA in the next segment, but before you got to NASA, what was the fastest aircraft you flew?
The fastest airplane in term of capability was I got checked out in F-15s, and they're good to 2.5 Mach. I never did go that fast in an Eagle, but I have had several times I've had the F-16 up to 2.05, which was its placard speed back then. I think it probably still is. And that seemed like it was plenty fast at the time.
Sounds fast enough for me, sir.
Yeah.
And just looking at your face when you're describing this, you enjoyed all of that, didn't you?
Well, I mean, really, who wouldn't?
Well, most pilots like speed, and they like those Corvettes and some of those fast cars, too.
Yeah, they like that feeling of power.
And, sir, this whole career worked its way up to the point where in 1996 you were selected as an astronaut candidate.
That's correct, sir. I had applied about 2 years before that. And nothing happened. They weren't interested. And then I was at Edwards doing the test pilot thing, having a good time. And NASA put on another call for astronauts. And somehow my wife heard that, and she said, "Well, are you going to apply again?" And I said, "Well, no, it's too much work." And she said, "No motorcycle racing this weekend. Get down to the squadron and put together a package. We're going to Houston." And she was right.
Sir, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to hear about the NASA experience and how that all worked. We're speaking with retired Lieutenant Colonel Digger Carey on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been talking with retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Digger Carey about his time in the service. He was born here in St. Paul, went to Highland Park High School. Took a couple of years off to figure out what you wanted to do, sir.
Yeah, that's exactly what it wasn't even that. I took a couple years off because I thought I was going to just kind of bump around on a motorcycle for the rest of my life. You know, 18-year-old young man, you don't have the greatest judgment. And I thought that was a way to live my life, you know, jumping trains and hobnobbing around the country on motorcycle, working odd jobs, typewriter repair at one time.
Hard to pay the bills that way, sir.
It was. And as I got older and more mature and I met a young lady that I really loved, I thought, well, how am I going to raise a family doing this? And she kind of convinced me that maybe we should throw some education into the mix and maybe a little military service. And by that time, I'd already fell in love, not so much with the United States, but the people of America. Because when I had nothing, I was always given odd jobs and a place to sleep and maybe food and stuff like that. And you know, you just fall in, the more you travel America, the more you fall in love with Americans. And I thought, well, you know, I'm young and I got good eyes and I'm in good shape. It's my turn to do my share and maybe look at the military and see if they'll have me.
So you went back to school and got to a couple of degrees at the University of Minnesota. So you're a Golden Gopher, and then you were commissioned as out of ROTC in 1981, flew A-10A Warthogs, and then took on F-16s and went to be an F-16 experimental test pilot. And then you had an opportunity in 1996 to join NASA. Can you tell us how that came about, sir?
Yeah, NASA was putting out the word that they were looking for applications, and all test pilots know that the only kind of astronaut pilots that NASA hires are those with test piloting experience. So if you're interested in the space program, you're in a good position as a test pilot to apply for the program. And then, quite frankly, after that, it's a matter of luck. And if the brakes go your way, well, then you get offered a chance to serve in the astronaut corps.
So you became an astronaut candidate in 1996, and how do you progress through that to get on the shuttle and be an astronaut, sir?
Basically, for us, sir, it was about a 2-year progression, learning as a pilot. My main thing I had to learn was the space shuttle itself, how to fly it, how to handle emergencies, those kinds of things. But there's a litany of other things you have to learn to be an astronaut, including, there was scuba diving in the mix. It helps prepare you for spacewalks and stuff like that. Russian language training, orbital mechanics, public speaking, all those kinds of different things. And to prepare you for this, you know, being an astronaut is much more than just flying the spaceships. You spend very little time doing that. You spend most of your time supporting the others that are flying in space, being a CAPCOM, working in mission control, those kinds of things. So there was a lot of training, but it was all a lot of fun. And being a believer in the space program and the importance of America's exploration efforts, it wasn't too hard to stay motivated during that 2 years of training.
And, sir, I understand that you were on the shuttle Columbia, STS-109, on the fourth Hubble Space Telescope servicing mission. Can you tell us a little about that, sir?
Yes, sir. I find it very interesting that during the motorcycle portion of my career running around the country and stuff like that, in a science fiction magazine, I had read about this future telescope that NASA was thinking about developing. This was back in the 80s, that they're going to fly in space. And I was thinking, that's really cool. I would do anything to be part of that. I would sweep floors. I'd do anything. And about 20 years after that, sir, I woke up one morning and I looked to the left, and there was the Hubble Space Telescope in the back of my spaceship. And I had been the pilot that took us up there to service it. It's wonderful. Dreams really do come true. They really do come true.
And what kind of shape was that in when you picked it up and put it in there to work on it?
It was in, from a distance, it was in great shape. If you got up real close to it, there's a lot of little nicks and pits all over it because it's up there in space and it's constantly being hit by little meteorites and stuff like that. But when the guys, I didn't go out to do any spacewalks to work on it, but when the guys opened up the panels to get inside and swap out components and stuff like that, they said it was pristine, even though it had been in space for about 12 years. They said it was pristine inside. And it was a testament to the engineers and the American workers that put that thing together and put it in space. It's a heck of a machine, and to this day it's working really, really good.
So you worked on it in spacewalks 5 days in a row and put it back in service?
Right. We went up there, and basically it wasn't broken when we got there, but some of the equipment was getting kind of antiquated, not a date. And anybody that works with computers, cell phones, those kinds of things, know how quickly technology advances. It's the same way with telescopes. So we basically gave her some new parts, and she was state-of-the-art by the time we were done with our mission.
Sir, I have to ask you, I've read that landing a space shuttle is an interesting experience.
Yes, it's a very, you know, as from a piloting point of view, it's no different than landing anything else, except for your margin for error is very, very slim, because any extra ounce of weight you have on a spaceship is several pounds of stuff that you can't take into space. I know it doesn't make sense, but that's how it works out with rocket science. And so what I'm getting at is the brakes are just barely big enough to handle a perfect landing. The tires are just barely strong enough to handle a perfect landing. So what I'm trying to say is every landing has to be close to a perfect landing, otherwise you're going to break the spaceship. And what pilot wants to be responsible for that?
Wouldn't want to be on that list, sir. And is
no,
that,
sir.
Is that like landing a great big glider?
It's a glider. It's a 225,000-pound glider that doesn't fly very well. The lift-to-drag ratio is about 2-1. Not much better than a brick.
But you brought her back in good shape, sir.
Well, we had. What choice did we have? You know, you make that, you practice that landing thousands of times before the mission. And you got it down to the point where you really could do it in your sleep. I mean, this is the training in NASA is like military training. We've all been there. When you're supposed to go do a job, you're thoroughly trained, and then you go do the job, and you know what to do because you're trained.
Sir, we just got a couple of minutes left. I noted in your bio that after that flight, you took over, or you served in the capacity of CAPCOM at Houston Mission Control. That had to be a real honor to do that, sir.
Yeah, it's a real honor to work with Mission Control and work with those professionals. Most people have no idea the level of expertise that's sitting in that room, and everyone thinks, well, you know, the astronaut is the most qualified one. Not even close. Anybody that's ever been involved in maintenance on complex machines and all that kind of stuff, they know how complicated it is. And those other members that are there in Mission Control, they are the world's best at what they do, and it's a real honor. That's why we put on the suit and tie before we go work in there. It's just a show of respect for all those that came before.
That was a culmination of an entire career to sit in that chair for those flights.
You're down right. And it's just like being in the military in general. You know, we're all part of a team. We get trained to do our job. And when you go out and you work together, you accomplish miraculous things that people could never do on their own.
Sir, we're just about out of time, but there's young people listening to the show all over Minnesota. What would you say to them if they're thinking about a career in the Air Force, and specifically if they thought they liked speed and wanted to be a pilot?
Well, if you like speed and you want to be a pilot, the bad news for a lot of kids is you got to have a college degree. But and you know, if you want to do it bad enough, you'll go do that like I did. I wasn't the world's greatest student, but I wanted to do it real bad. But the main thing I can say about the military for a kid that spent a lot of time in the projects growing up here in St. Paul is when you get into the military, it's pretty much the closest thing to a pure meritocracy that you're going to find in the United States anymore. You get promoted and you get recognition based on your abilities, not based on your background or where you came from. It's the job you can do. And I found as a young person that had a modest background, it was incredibly satisfying to go in and be on a level playing field with kids who were like children of generals and stuff like that. I mean, I could compete just based on your abilities, and that's the number one thing I loved about the military. And the honor of serving is something that no one can ever explain unless they've experienced it. And that's an honor that you keep within yourself. It's a pride that you have, you live with. And anybody that's considering it, get out there and give it a shot. Be part of America's finest team, the finest team in the world.
Sir, congratulations on a terrific career, and we'd like to thank you for joining us today on Minnesota Military Radio.
Well, thanks for your service, and thanks for what you guys are doing. It's great.
Thank you, sir. That was retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dwayne Digger Carey on Minnesota Military Radio.
Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to hear from a group that is helping veterans enter the construction field. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shalito.
December 7th marks the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the veterans community will gather to honor and remember this war, those who fought, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice. It is humbling each year to be in the presence of Pearl Harbor survivors and a reminder to how few remain with us today. President Roosevelt declared that December 7th will be a day that will live in infamy. Each and every day I am reminded of the sacrifices Pearl Harbor veterans made as I see the 4-inch gun from the USS Ward that sits just west of the Veterans Service Building here in St. Paul. We honor and remember our heroes who are with us today and those who have passed.
Thank you, Commissioner Chalideau. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Helmets to Hard Hats is charged with helping veterans find job opportunities as they make the difficult transition back to civilian life. The nonprofit program is dedicated to helping National Guard, Reserve, retired and transitioning active duty military members connect to quality career and training opportunities in one of America's most challenging and rewarding industries, the construction industry. And here to talk to us today about Helmets to Hard Hats is Joel Welter and Larry Gilbertson. Gentlemen, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Welcome to you. Thank you, sir.
Joel, I want to start with you. I understand you're the director of the Minnesota Helmets to Hard Hats program.
That's correct. I took this position in late October and just getting my feet under me and learning all the different actors within the state who can help veterans find employment.
Now, Joel, I understand you're currently in the military.
That's correct. I'm in the Army Reserve in Minnesota.
And you've been deployed a couple of times.
Twice so far, and we're looking at a third one here coming up in the spring.
So you're a busy guy.
Yes, sir.
And your position now, as you said, you're director of Minnesota Helmets to Hard Hats. And what are you trying to attract the military, people coming out of the military, people that might want to go into construction trades? And what's the mission of Helmets to Hard Hats, to help them access those trades?
That's exactly right, Tom. The mission of Helmets to Hard Hats is to help any veteran, any military service member find a career in a construction apprenticeship program in the building trades. I work exclusively in Minnesota, helping Minnesota veterans find good career opportunities within construction.
And do you provide some training then? If I'm coming off active duty, say out of the Army, and maybe I was an electrician or something, and I want to get into the trades and get certified and get in the union, can you help me with that?
I can help you with that. My job is to assist veterans with finding the right path towards a career in construction. For example, if you were an electrician in the military and wanted to pursue that career in the construction trades, I can get you in contact with any one of the electricians locals in Minnesota and get you on the right path to applying to and getting accepted in an apprenticeship program.
Now, if I've been in the military for a number of years and I come out, do I have to start as a basic apprentice, or do I get credit for what I've done and learned and experienced in the military?
That all depends on your military experience, Tom. In a lot of cases, there are a lot of transferable skills from the military to construction. For example, if you have electrical experience within the military, you may be able to transfer into an apprenticeship in an advanced stage, such as, for example, halfway through the apprenticeship, or potentially even as a journey person if you have the proper skills.
Now, Larry, I want to come to you. I understand that you also served in the military as a paratrooper.
Yes, that's right, sir.
And when was that?
1982 to 1984, I served proudly with the 82nd Airborne Division.
That's quite a division to serve with, wasn't it?
I agree with you. Yes, sir.
Now, I understand, Larry, that you're the training director for Helmets to Hard Hats. Is that correct?
Actually, I'm the training director for the Ironworkers Local 512, and I'm the president of the Apprenticeship Coordinators Association of Minnesota. So I'm kind of chair that group and handle the outreach within all the trades and kind of serve at functions like this at the behest of that group.
Now, can you explain to me how you work with Helmets to Hard Hats and how you work with Joel?
Yep. We all the trades in the Twin Cities area here and throughout the state of Minnesota, I should say, are very actively seeking to get veterans into our programs. They have great success rates. They're used to the hard work, their physical abilities, and working outdoors, which is something that's in the construction. And also we feel that, you know, we need to give these veterans every opportunity they can to be successful in life. They've served our country, and we need to do all we can to help repay them.
We're talking about Helmets to Hard Hats on Minnesota Military Radio. Larry, I think everyone in Minnesota knows the unemployment rate is about as low as I can remember in my lifetime. And it seems like there's a lot of construction going on. You need men and women, don't you?
Yes, we do. And also, there's a lot of baby boomers getting ready to retire. So about half of the union membership in Minnesota is about over the age of 45, and about 25% is over the age of 55. So there's going to be a lot of shoes to fill in the future here.
So there's plenty of opportunities, and if you can get some of our military back from all the things they've experienced and gone through, you've got some good, dedicated men that are, and women that are ready to go to work. They got to make great employees.
Yes, sir. I concur.
All right, Joel, I want to come to you now for our listeners. If they want to find out information on helmets to hard hats, where do they go?
The best way to learn more about helmets to hard hats is to visit our website, helmetstohardhats.org. Simply register, fill out a profile. It takes about 5 minutes. I'll be able to see you once you register on the website, and I'll be able to contact you and help you out with any types of questions you might have about becoming a building trades apprentice.
Now, as we talked about, there's a big demand for apprentices and for people in the trades, as big a demand as I can remember in the last four decades. What can you do for a military member coming off active duty? How can you help them access those jobs quicker?
So what I can do for them, Tom, is I have a good working relationship with all the building trades in Minnesota, and I can basically get them on the right path potentially quicker than they could do working by themselves. I have good relationships with all the apprenticeship training coordinators. I understand how their programs work, when they'd be willing to take apprentices into their programs, and I can just speed their transition from either active duty or the reserve or guard into a building trade.
So once one of our service members reaches you at Helmets to Hard Hats, how long does it take them to go through the sign-up period, the apprentice? How long does it take them to get to work?
Well, normally you can go to work in one of the building trades at different times of the year. Some depend on the demand for work. Some trades take apprentices at certain times during the year. So there's not really one easy answer to that question. It really depends on what field you're interested in. But typically, you can get out to work very quickly in one of the trades because there's such a high demand. There's an economic urgency to fill jobs in the trades, especially when it comes to female veterans. Minnesota has changed its goal from 6% female employment in the trades to 20%, and all the trades are working very hard to recruit female employees, and female veterans at this point are highly, highly employable. So odds are they could go to work almost immediately.
And, of course, there's more women serving in the military today than ever there has been. I believe in the Minnesota National Guard, as many as 25% of them are women. And, Larry, when you get them in, if they wanted to become go through your program, how long does it take them? How long does it usually take them to go through that training program and get on a job, or is it all part of the same deal?
In our trade, it's usually the longest period would probably be 6 months. But it's usually be shorter than that. We also have some programs, and a lot of trades are able to immediately slot people in, especially for if they have that veteran status. A lot of them have what's called an actual direct entry, where if they go and apply with these trades and they are a veteran, they can almost start work almost immediately.
So they actually would get some credit for what they have learned in the military and maybe jump to the front of the line, or while they're going into the training, they can go out in the field as well.
That's correct, Tom.
So they can start earning quick.
Yes, yep. That's the main thing. Get that money in the pocket right there.
So you're smiling. I'm thinking you want to see as many men and women veterans as you can.
Yes, we've been a push for that for the last 9 years that I've been doing the job with the ironworkers. We've had a great amount of success with these folks. And once again, we feel that we need to do all we can for our veterans, for all they've done for our country.
Joel, are all the trades as excited as Larry is?
I think they are, Tom. I've had a chance to meet with most of the trades, and every single one of them is supportive of hiring veterans. They're supportive of the Helmets to Hard Hats program, and they're eager to get as many qualified vets in there as possible.
So when a veteran comes to you and they're just coming off of duty, you take a look at what they've done and what they've experienced in life and ask them which trade they want to be involved in, and then you go find the Larry from that right trade, right?
That's exactly right. There's a lot of Larrys out there looking for veterans.
All right, very good, gentlemen. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about Helmets to Hard Hats on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been talking to the guys from Helmets to Hard Hats, and we've been talking to Joel Welter and Larry Gilbertson. And Joel, I want to come back to you. One of the things we haven't talked about so far today is GI Bill. If our service members coming back off active duty, we're on active duty, they're eligible for GI Bill. If they're Guard or Reserve and they've been deployed long enough, they've got some GI Bill they're eligible for. Is this one of the things you want to talk to them about when they come to you and you first sit down?
Yes, it is, Tom. When I first sit down with a veteran, I like to discuss what their experience is and also where their interests lie to help them get a good idea of what trade might be the best fit for them. No matter which trade they pick, all the building trades apprenticeship programs are accredited through the state of Minnesota. All veterans are eligible to use both their post-9/11 GI Bill and their Minnesota GI Bill to help cover costs and expenses during their time at an apprenticeship program.
So can they get in a program where maybe they're going to night school to get some of these college credits and they can be an apprentice and work during the day as well?
That's typically how most programs work. They're all structured a little differently, Tom. Some have exclusively night school. Some apprentices go to school one day per week. Some apprenticeships do have a period of day school from 9 months to 2 years, and some only do school on weekends. So all the trades run their programs a little bit differently, but the bottom line is you can work and go to school at the same time, and you can use your GI Bill while you're doing it.
And you can show them how to do that. And for our listeners out there, if you're interested in getting help from this organization, go to helmetstohardhats.org, and they can just go on there and find all the information. What's on your website?
They can. They can register on the website. They can use it to search for union apprenticeships that might be in their area. And I can also see them on the website, and I make it a point to reach out to every veteran who signs up in Minnesota to sit down with them and talk and get them the information they need.
So I'll start at the website, helmetstohardhats.org, and then go see Joel, and he'll point you in the right direction for school and for an apprenticeship and for everything they need to know to access the trades in the quickest way possible, correct?
That's exactly right.
All right, Larry, I understand that you're familiar with a pilot program they're doing at North Hennepin Community College.
That's correct, Tom. Yeah, we just began a pilot program to allow our students to take their training hours that they've done with our apprenticeship program and turn those into college credit hours. So they can go to the North Hennepin Community College and get 27 of the credits they need for a 60-credit degree in construction technology. And they can already have that, about half of that degree program done already upon successful completion of their apprenticeship program. So not only will they learn the trade from the very best subject matter experts that are out there, but they've got a chance to turn that into college credits for pursuing an advanced degree beyond that.
Now, do they have an opportunity to get some college credits for their experience in the military if they were in one of the trades in the military?
Certainly so, yes.
And that pilot program can help with that, too?
Yes, it can, yes.
All right. Joel, I imagine that's another question that if somebody served on active duty for 4 or 5 years and they're, or even 10 years and they're coming off and they were a plumber or they were an electrician, something like that, learned it in the military, you know, now they come out and they're civilian. Nobody's giving them credit for what they learned in the military, but there must be a way to speed them into the trades.
That does help quite a bit when a service member has skills they can apply directly to a trade that they learned in the military. That can do a number of things for them. One thing, it could advance them in their standing in the apprenticeship. For example, it could reduce a 5 or 4 year apprenticeship program down to 2 or 3 years. Or in some cases, if somebody has enough experience that's documented in the military on active duty, they could even test out as a journey person on some of our trades.
So the place for them really to start is helmetstohardhats.org. Get a hold of you. You can figure out what their experience they've had and what they want to do, and then show them the most expedient way to get to it.
Yes, I can, Tom.
And I know Larry's over here sitting smiling and shaking his head. You want to put them through your training program and get them to work right away, don't you?
I certainly do, yes.
Is there plenty
of
work?
All the trades have a need for it, yep. We need the best and the brightest we can get, and a lot of those folks are coming straight out of our military.
Well, Larry, I'm glad you're ready to train them. And Joel, once again, your website?
helmetstohardhats.org.
You're ready, willing, and able to help our service members returning from whether it's active duty, guard, reserve, and get them into the trades and show them the best way to do it.
We'll do everything we can to help them.
Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Joel Welter and Larry Gilbertson talking about helmetstohardhats.org on Minnesota Military Radio. Joining me now is the president of the Navy League here in Minnesota, Brian Scon. Brian, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks, Tom, once again for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Always good to talk to you, Brian, and get updates on the United States Navy and the USS Minnesota and a lot of other things. But before we get into that, can you tell us what's the mission of the Navy League here in Minnesota?
Well, the primary mission of the Navy League here in Minnesota and at our national headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, is to support our sea services and how we support our sea services. For example, 2 weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C. at our national directors meeting, and we also included a day to go lobby members of Congress for Navy and sea services funding, which includes Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. So that's what we do locally here in Minnesota. We support our Naval Recruiting District. We support our Naval Operations Support Center with our 700 Minnesota Drilling Reservists. We also support our fast attack submarine USS Minnesota, and we're going to be responsible for commissioning the new littoral combat ship Minneapolis St. Paul. So we're a busy group. We're a very busy group.
Brian, I think when we first met, it was in connection with the USS Minnesota, and with your help, we were able to take the radio show out to Norfolk, Virginia, and tour the boat, interview the captain, the chief of the boat, and the secretary of the Navy, and wow, that was a great trip.
Yeah, and we appreciated you having out there and supporting that historic event.
Now, we got another one coming up, because on the far side of Wisconsin, they're building a new boat. It is the USS Minneapolis St. Paul, and I understand you were over there recently.
Yeah, on October 23rd, I did a shipyard tour with Senator Michelle Benson, Senator Scott Dibble. Representative Jim Nash was supposed to be, and he ended up getting sick. We also had Chip Langan from the Minnesota Defense Alliance, as well as our Vice President Bill James. And we toured the shipyard, and we saw four littoral combat ships, our Freedom-class ships, on the waterfront, one of which was complete, the USS Little Rock, LCS number 9. And then we also saw components of the Minneapolis St. Paul, including outside the pilot house, sitting on stanchions. And this pilot house is a few hundred tons. So it was quite an amazing shipyard tour, and grateful to see components of Minneapolis St. Paul, LCS 21, and grateful to see it moving along.
Now, are they going to have a keel-laying ceremony coming up soon?
The information I received on October 23rd is they are targeting January 2018, so just less than 2 months from now, we will have the initial ceremony, where they're suggesting launch is early January, early 2019, with commission in early 2020. So we're still about 2 years out in terms of the actual final commissioning ceremony, but it's quite a process. I'd also like to let your listeners know that to launch a Freedom-class littoral combat ship, they do it sideways. Because if they launched it, which is something that's traditional, stern first, it would hit the other side of the Marinette River. So they actually launch it sideways. It rocks back and forth, and if you want to go on YouTube, you can see that launch, and it's quite an amazing event.
Brian, keep us up to date on that. We want to follow the construction and the commissioning of that boat right along with you. But we have to keep moving. Recently, in the news, we saw that there were, for the first time in a decade, three United States aircraft carriers in the Sea of Japan.
Yeah, it was the Nimitz, the Ronald Reagan, and the, I'm going to blank, I think it was the Theodore Roosevelt.
I think it was.
And all three of them did exercises off the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, we all see, especially with the recent ballistic missile launch yesterday, that is a hot spot for the world. And there's no question, in my opinion, it was a message, even though official Navy said it wasn't. Anytime you have that level of firepower in the area, that's significant. And that is a message to all our allies of our support, of our capability, and what we're going to do to support them, as well as their adversaries, to let them know we're keeping an eye on them.
We may not see three of those in the same area again for another decade, but what a historic event.
Well, what was also amazing, and this was pointed out by the Navy and pointed out by other organizations, that at one point, for the first time in a decade, we had seven aircraft carriers operational out at sea, both in training, both on deployment at the same time. A couple of weeks ago, we almost missed number eight when my daughter's ship came in the same day my son's ship went out, and that would have made eight out of 11 being deployed. And for years we've had situations with deferred maintenance, and I truly believe good news is we're catching up, and that's why we're able to put all those aircraft carriers out at one time and be able to be ready to respond to the president's call if necessary.
Brian, we've only got about a minute and a half left here, but I know that want to let our listeners know that you recently experienced a loss in your family. your father-in-law, one of the grandfathers of your children, and that you have two children in the Navy, a daughter and a son, and you went through that Red Cross notification process to get them home. Can you tell us how that worked?
Well, yeah, it was really interesting. My father-in-law was former state representative Paul Osnes, and he lives in the Fergus Falls area. Some of your listeners might know who he is. And it was an eye opener for me to be able to have to go through the Red Cross. I contacted the Red Cross. They had to verify the event occurred. Then they contacted both my kids' ships. One's on the West Coast, one's on the East Coast. And they had to contact the commands to verify the event took place. And then they were released to come back. So it was quite a process, and I would encourage all parents and all family members to understand that in the event of an emergency leave, the need for an emergency leave, your starting point is the American Red Cross, and they do an awesome job. They did a great job for us.
They were right there when you needed them, and I saw some photos on Facebook, so you were able to gather the family around and honor your father-in-law who had passed.
Yes, and it was so. Touching that the Red Cross was able to make that happen, as well as the United States Navy.
Brian, thanks for joining us again.
And thanks for having me on one more time, and I appreciate your support of the Navy.
Thanks, Brian. That was Brian Skahn, the president of the Minnesota's Navy League on Minnesota Military Radio. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Lieutenant Colonel Digger Carey, Joel Welter, Larry Gilbertson, Brian Skahn from the Minnesota Navy League, Commissioner Larry Shelleto of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General John Jensen. Please join us next week as we talk about Minnesota's 1st Brigade Red Bulls and meet the commander of the Disabled American Veterans of Minnesota. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.